This video is sponsored by Squarespace. More about them in just a moment. Manifestation promises that we can achieve our dreams, conquer any obstacle, and be the master of our own lives. But it has also been accused of massively overstating its claims and selling a bogus philosophy that says all the victims of the world's misfortunes brought it on themselves. It is both extremely popular and extremely controversial. So, let's take a look at the history and philosophical system of manifestation to see where it's come from, what it claims, and where it goes extremely wrong. My name is Joe Folley, and this is Unsolicited Advice. 1. History, Metaphysics, and Spiritual Science. Proponents of manifestation, or the law of attraction as it's otherwise known, often argue that it is a continuation of ancient spiritual traditions, often those of Hermeticism or mysticism. And, to be fair, they are not totally wrong here. Manifestation is not the work of one or two people, but sprang out of a fascinating period of 19th century American history where the spiritual and the scientific were working out where each other stood in the realm of human inquiry. This potted history will obviously be a simplification and leave some major influences out, but it should be sufficient for our purposes today. Bear in mind that this is not a history of manifestation, but rather the movements that manifestation grew out of. In her phenomenal book, A Republic of Mind and Spirit, Catherine Albanese traces the history of modern metaphysical traditions like manifestation and their origins in the 19th century. This period actually saw far more detailed attempts at a sophisticated philosophy to support these spiritual practices than we often see today, but they nonetheless continue to hum in the background of our modern outcrops. So, what were the pillars of this so-called metaphysical religion? Well, firstly, there is the primacy of mind over matter. This is partly a metaphysical thesis and partly an ethical one. The mind is seen as the creative force that, in some way, gives rise to the reality around us. At the extreme end, this tends towards outright idealism, where reality is wholly or mostly born from the mind. But more modest versions simply point out that our experiences are necessarily mind-dependent. There is often an ardent faith in the power of the mind. Thought itself is seen as able to cause the world to change, but separate from any action that thought might more straightforwardly cause. In some variants, this stretches to the idea that humans are capable of telepathy, telekinesis, or communing with the dead. The most popular theory of the 19th century around mind power was that you could think yourself out of an illness. But in manifestation, the primary claim is that thoughts about reality attract that reality to you. So, if I think about wealth and believe I am already wealthy, then wealth will come to me. And if I believe I am poor and focus on that poverty, then poverty will come to me. This causal efficacy of the mind is put succinctly in Rhonda Byrne's book, The Secret, where she says, "You can completely change every circumstance and event in your entire life by changing the way that you think." Put a pin in this idea, as we will be coming back to it in a lot more detail in the next section. In addition to this, in 19th century metaphysical religion, the mental is often thought to be ethically superior to the physical, in a way that's ever so slightly reminiscent of Gnosticism. Some thinkers claimed that we could ascend into different realms, with the realms becoming more spiritual and less physical as they got higher, both metaphorically and arguably literally. This process was often thought to occur over different lifetimes, and it's a strange mixture of occultism and borrowed parts of Buddhism and Hinduism, though I should note that this idea of separate realms was not universally held, and the accounts of different realms varied between practitioners, because this movement was not one unified thing, it was just a variety of different thinkers all touching upon similar themes. Alongside this primacy of thought and mind, there was often a proposed medium through which these thoughts could enact their changes on the world. In more recent versions, this has become closely associated with energy fields and frequencies, but in the 19th century, they mainly used the idea of an ether or an astral light. These more closely aligned with the scientific theories of the day, which often posited some kind of ether through which physical forces acted. With the advent of electromagnetism and the increasing prevalence of mathematical fields in 20th century physics, the language changed to reflect this. Tellingly, many modern descendants of these movements use terms like quantum in their own metaphysical systems. The general trend is to try to connect whatever metaphysical medium explains the mysterious power of thought to some credible scientific theory that is around at the time. This is partly a rhetorical tactic, but it also reflects an underlying ethos behind many of the 19th century metaphysical religionists. They often saw spiritualism as a kind of science that could be studied. Henry Olcott practiced what Albanese calls exoteric theosophy. Theosophy was the metaphysical school of thought that he founded with another enthusiast called Helena Blavatsky. But whereas Blavatsky was very esoteric, prizing ancient mysteries handed down by so-called masters and believing that deep spiritual knowledge was the purview of the few, Olcott was something of a spiritual democrat. He thought that spirituality would follow predefined laws just as physics does. And just as anyone could learn how to build a bridge with sufficient study, anyone could learn how to take advantage of these spiritual laws. This tension between exotericism and esotericism is still seen today in the language around manifestation. On the one hand, it is often prized as a great secret, but on the other, it is considered a law, the law of attraction, that functions as predictably and mechanically as the laws of gravity or electromagnetism, and is specifically open to all. Later, these ideas were incorporated into a more explicitly Christian theology with the advent of Christian Science, which a Catholic priest once quipped to me was neither properly Christian nor properly science. Here, unpleasant phenomena, primarily sickness, is interpreted as deviation from God and the divine spirit. Affirmations were then seen as ways to reshape the world through changing the subconscious mind. They were sort of an outcrop of prayer, but with the emphasis far more on the prayer than on God. The term Christian Science was eventually trademarked, leading to two simultaneous movements emerging side by side: Christian Science on the one hand, and New Thought on the other. Though New Thought would also come to incorporate some non-Christian elements. This is also where the work of Phineas Quimby becomes quite influential, who some of you may have heard of. There was also considerable influence from Eastern thought, or rather, slightly bastardized versions of Eastern thought. Metaphysical religionists borrowed certain practices like meditation and the general idea of Brahman as a principle of being, but they also scorned any elements that they did not like. For example, Paul Caruth brought many Buddhist teachings and practices into New Thought, but he also removed much of the substance in Buddhist philosophy. Rather than talking of Anatman or non-self and its intimate connection to nirvana and enlightenment, Caruth instead simply spoke of a higher state that we could achieve if we only filled ourselves with truth. There is an element of philosophical mugging going on here. Nonetheless, it was incorporated into this general metaphysical movement. However, it is largely in the 20th century that some of the more modern forms of metaphysical religious thinking came to the fore, with an increasing emphasis on economic success. Sometimes this led to more modest versions of the power of thought, such as Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich. While this maintained the idea that self-belief and thought were powerful, Hill's book did not argue that thought could affect the world apart from action, but rather through action. It is primarily motivational rather than mystical. Other books, like The Power of Positive Thinking, blur these lines a little bit more. On the other end of the spectrum, the 2006 book, The Secret, by far the most popular modern book on manifestation in metaphysical religion, goes even further than most 19th century works in affirming the absolute primacy of thought above everything else, where even questioning whether something can be achieved by manifestation is dangerous doubt that can threaten the manifestation in question. Some other videos I've watched and articles I've read on this topic have painted manifestation, New Thought, and New Age thinking as primarily an outgrowth of evangelical Christianity. And there is certainly some truth to this, especially in the case of Christian Science. But Albanese offers a different and slightly more nuanced picture. She argues that this metaphysical turn in American religion has its roots in certain occult and esoteric traditions in Europe, as well as incorporating elements of Eastern thought and just good old-fashioned superstitions about ghosts, mediums, and communing with the dead, all mixed in with the general idea that the spiritual world might follow strict laws just as the physical one does. It has a certain amount of crossover with the prosperity gospel in Christianity, and also, obviously, with the modern self-help movement. The entire domain of New Age philosophy is genuinely quite interesting from a historical perspective, but it's also far too much to cover in this video. But What exactly is manifestation specifically? And why is it so controversial? But before moving on, I want to take a quick moment to thank our very kind sponsors, Squarespace. If you're looking to build a website, then you know it can be a real hassle. First, you have to find a domain name and then construct the entire website. And there's always the underlying fear that you're messing up and creating something that just looks unprofessional. But this is where Squarespace comes into play. They compress all of that complexity and headache into a single platform and use ready-made templates to take all of that pain out of website building. They also have a feature called Blueprint AI, which uses AI tools to help you make design choices, which is really handy if, like me, you are not technologically gifted at all and don't have the mind of a graphic designer. Head to squarespace.com/unsolicitedadvice and use the code unsolicitedadvice to get 10% off your first purchase of a domain name or a website. Anyway, back to the video. 2. Manifestation, theory and practice. I have honestly enjoyed reading about manifestation for this video far more than I thought I would, partly because it does contain some plausible starting points, but then it takes these starting points in incredibly bizarre directions, employing fallacious reasoning and leading to unsubstantiated conclusions. At its base level, the act of manifesting is simply thinking about something you want and believing it will happen. Different practitioners describe this process differently. Some recommend writing the desire down. Others recommend visualization or painting. Sometimes particular states of mind are seen as especially conducive to manifestation, such as meditation or the border between sleep and wakefulness. The idea that this might help you achieve your goals is not totally out there. When I sit down to write these videos, I do think what I want to write about, and then I write it. Various therapeutic practices like cognitive behavioral therapy do encourage calm mental states, while positive psychology does advise people to interpret events as positively as is reasonable. As I've said before, achieving anything requires some degree of focus, and this often involves focusing on the thing you want to achieve. Some people who talk about manifestation seem to mean something like this. In this situation, to manifest something is actually a pretty mundane process. It just means to work towards it in a concentrated and directed manner. And I don't think this is a bad idea. It won't guarantee results, as life always has a healthy dose of chance and a dollop of factors outside of our immediate control, but it's certainly not awful advice. Additionally, having particular rituals around focusing on something doesn't sound like too much of a bad idea either. The use of bells or mantras to mark out certain periods of time as for concentrating have been employed by many religions to aid with various practices. It's partly just Pavlovian conditioning. If you know that a certain bell signifies a moment of prayer, you'll begin to associate that sound with the act of praying, and so it will be easier to relax into proceedings. As long as manifestation is used in this way, I think it's broadly quite positive. If framing concentration and work as something mystical helps you, then go for it. When I was a teenager, I used to make studying more fun by putting on some fantasy music and analogizing my work to being a wizard. It might be a bit odd, but it's basically harmless. But also, if this were where manifestation ended, then there would be no controversy about it at all. The trouble is when it becomes an ontological principle known as the law of attraction. This law relies on the metaphysical power of thoughts that we discussed in the last section, and claims that thoughts themselves have the ability to attract certain events to you. Oftentimes, the reasoning behind this is a leap in logic from the idea that thoughts can influence other thoughts to the idea that they can influence things in the world separate from action. It is true that one negative thought can lead to another negative thought, and that this may influence your mood and in turn your experience of your day, but it doesn't follow from this that further negative events are attracted to you merely by the action of your thought. In 2020, there was a resurgence of interest in The Secret, renewing its influence among modern manifestors. In this book, the primary causal force in the universe is thought, and even action is mainly seen as powerful in as much as it reflects a strong thought. To again quote directly from the text, "Actions are particularly powerful because they are thoughts that have caused us to act." This is very different from using the idea of manifestation as a kind of tool to organize your actions. It is placing thought itself as causal and action as a kind of side effect. It's honestly quite a strange picture of the world. The culmination of this is a view of the universe as a genie that grants your wishes as long as you wish hard enough and in the right way. Byrne even likens manifestation to shopping through a catalogue, picking out the things you want, and waiting for the universe to grant them. She explicitly says not to worry about how you are going to achieve something, but just to know that you will. Truly a faith to move mountains. The most important thing is the elimination of doubt, because doubt is seen to weaken the wish being made to the universe. Manifestation involves a highly teleological view of reality. That is, that the universe has some purpose. But unlike most major world religions, the person setting the teleology is you. The universe does not work according to the designs of a higher power, but is instead the output of the thoughts of those in the universe. This is why Byrne capitalizes the word you throughout her book. The individual human being is the theological center of manifestation philosophy. Metaphysically, the world itself is seen as mind-dependent, with reality unfolding merely as a result of thoughts. This honestly sounds like I'm straw-manning Byrne, so I'm again going to quote her. Quantum physicists tell us that the entire universe emerged from thought. You create your life through your thoughts and the law of attraction. I can only assume that she's referring to observer effects in quantum physics here. Needless to say, they do not tell us that the entire universe emerged from thought, nor do they say that we create our life through our thoughts and a mysterious spiritual law. If I were to coin a term for this worldview, it would probably be agential idealism. It goes well beyond the more modest idea that we perceive the universe through our particularly human lens, or even Berkeley's theory that the world is made of ideas in the mind of God. Rather, our thoughts actually cause reality, and so when we change our thoughts, we change reality itself. This is part of what allows manifestation to make some internal sense. If you think that all reality is fundamentally created by or dependent on thought, then the notion that thoughts by themselves can transform the external world doesn't seem so implausible. The same goes for the idea that the universe is made of particular energies or frequencies, and that our thoughts are also energies or frequencies. Once everything is mental and everything is, in a sense, thought, it is a short leap to claim a causal chain between two mental events. This is what allows Byrne to infer from one thought affecting another thought to thoughts affecting non-thoughts. In her ontology, basically everything is thought. I wanted to outline this more ontological side of manifestation, because from the outside, it can be almost impossible to tell how people end up being convinced of this worldview, but its base concepts actually fit together relatively well. If you sell someone on the idea that the universe is primarily thought, then the rest quite plausibly follows from that. Of course, many scientists have noted there is a pretty healthy use of pseudoscience here as well. Byrne presents a caricatured idea of quantum physics that just so happens to cohere with her picture of the world. She also appeals to the idea that Einstein disproved the existence of time, or that Isaac Newton knew about the law of attraction and this was key to his genius, both of which are questionable claims. Talk of frequencies sounds scientific. After all, frequencies are mentioned in certain parts of mathematics and physics, and all of this uses the aesthetics of scientific support without having to provide any strong positive evidence for the predictive power of manifestation or of the law of attraction. As we saw in the last section, this is something that modern manifestation heavily borrowed from the 19th century. I should also point out here that there is no credible empirical evidence that the law of attraction is true as a metaphysical or ontological principle. While positive thinking has been linked with improved mood, as you might expect, manifestation supposedly works through totally immeasurable means. It is, by its nature, unfalsifiable, as we'll go into in the next section, and the scientific evidence used to support it, like the placebo effect or positive psychological outcomes or principles from quantum mechanics, are routinely either misused or are better explained by some psychological phenomenon rather than some mystical force. I don't want to spend the rest of the video debunking a fish in a barrel, and many other videos already exist rebutting manifestation and the law of attraction, but I also didn't want this to go unsaid. But, as Aristotle pointed out, with certain metaphysical ideas also come related ethical principles, and the ethics of manifestation is highly interesting, and also, possibly, a little bit worrying. If you want to help me make more videos like this, then please consider becoming one of my wonderful supporters on Patreon to gain access to exclusive content, including most recently my full interview with friend of the channel, Alex O'Connor. 3. Responsibility and Thought Act. Since manifestation thinking does not have a set of fixed tenets, different authors approach the issue of responsibility in slightly different ways, but they all tend to face the same difficulty, asserting that we are totally responsible for whatever happens to us, and even the very reality that, on their view, we create. One of the purported strengths of manifestation is that it is an empowering philosophy. It tells us that our thoughts can achieve, well, almost anything, and that the universe is a fundamentally giving force, all too happy to provide for us if only we ask in the right way, and in some cases, ask persistently. But, as Uncle Ben once famously alluded to, the flip side of power is responsibility. If we can change our own lives in such a straightforward way, then the obvious question is, why are we all not totally blissed out of our minds, achieving everything we have ever wanted totally effortlessly? And the primary answer the manifestors give is that we are putting out negative thoughts into the universe and so getting negativity in return. When we think, we also act. We have thought acts. And those thought acts have consequences that we are responsible for, both for better and for worse. In most philosophical systems, we are seen as in control of some things, but also not of others. In Stoicism, we are in control of our actions and our reasoning mind, but not much else. In some modern philosophies, we are in control of even less, since we come ready packaged with certain psychological predispositions from our childhood that we did not reasonably choose, but were instead forced upon us. Many thinkers draw the line at action. That is, when we do something, we then incur a responsibility. Manifestation is pretty unique in assuming we are in control of everything that happens to us, but this does have some nasty implications. Take the case of those living around the Chernobyl nuclear power plant during the disaster in 1986. Many of these people suffered and died horribly from nuclear radiation. On almost any other philosophy, these are the victims of a disaster. But, according to manifestation, they brought it on themselves. Byrne even says this outright in a slightly strange and now somewhat infamous passage. When people first hear this part of the secret, they recall events in history where masses of lives were lost. By the law of attraction, they had to be on the same frequency as the event. In some ways, I really applaud Byrne for just biting the bullet here. In the end, she affirms that, yes, they did bring it on themselves. In some sense, they were the cause of their own demise. Now, I'm not denying that sometimes people truly do cause their own pain. I've spoken about self-destructive behavior at length in other videos. But to say that every one of us causes every single awful thing that has ever happened to us is both quite unfounded and essentially amounts to assigning total responsibility to innocent victims of tragedies. Does the baby with inexplicable sudden infant death syndrome deserve their fate? Or was it instead their parents that brought it on? This sort of ethical conclusion arguably amounts to a reductio ad absurdum of the moral system implied, and sometimes just outright stated, by manifestation. It becomes unclear whether we can even hold people evaluable for the harm they do others. If I were to go out and murder someone, would the responsibility for that action be on me? After all, my victim would have to, in some sense, be on the same frequency as the murder and have attracted it to them. At some broad metaphysical level, they were asking for it. So when I am hauled in front of the judge, I could actually make a pretty solid argument that no murder was committed, but that my victim requested to be killed at their deepest level. I was simply carrying out the actions of the friendly universe that Byrne is so very keen on. This brings me quite neatly onto the next tension in manifestation philosophy. What happens when I manifest the actions of another person, and where does the ethical responsibility for those events then lie? A big theme of many manifestation tracks is romantic success. This makes perfect sense. People want to find love, so it is precisely the kind of thing that they might ask the universe to give them. But then, if I manifest someone falling in love with me, and this truly is a law of the universe that they cannot resist any more than the law of gravity, then I have overridden their agency in doing this, right? At the very least, it is an important question that needs clarification, and opinions seem to vary. Writers like Esther Hicks appear to take something of a middle path, saying that we can influence the behaviour of other people with our manifestations, but we can't outright control them. On the other hand, Byrne and some other authors like Neville Goddard are significantly more extreme. Byrne describes how one man manifested himself into sleeping with lots of women and then into a happy monogamous marriage. If this truly is like a catalogue, ordering events off a cosmic menu, then this seems somewhat dubious. It reminds me of the love potions in Tristan and Isolde, which tragically override the hero and the heroine's freedom and forces them to love one another. And this becomes even stranger if we consider criminal actions. If I manifest that someone else commits a crime on my behalf, who is morally on the hook for that? Is it them, or me, or both? It seems a little bit unclear. And this is no small issue. If the proponents of manifestation are correct, then this is the most powerful force in the universe, and the way that we think reshapes reality at its base level. So how our ethical responsibility is worked out here is absolutely vital. There is also significant internal tension in the manifestation worldview, since people often have competing visions of reality that are totally irreconcilable with one another. It's all very well saying that we have a near-infinite power to reshape reality, but what if the infinite power who lives next door to me reshapes reality into the opposite of what I want? After all, if the man in Byrne's book can manifest beautiful women, then why couldn't my neighbour manifest my agreement to trim my hedges more often? Why couldn't an elite crew of master manifestors swing entire elections? These questions are very rarely addressed in literature around manifestation, but it is a gaping hole in their theory of the world. I think there's a kind of subtle solipsism that works in the background of a lot of manifestation writing. In practice, and as Aquinas showed in Summa Contra Gentiles, there can only be one being of infinite power, and if there are multiple beings of infinite power, then neither of them truly have infinite power. And when confronted with this, a lot of the authors backtrack. Some, like Esther Hicks, resolve it by saying that the strongest and most focused manifester can sway the universe in their favour. Others suggest that there is a universal teleology that decides. Often there's a lot of hand-waving that goes on. A number of writers say that while we can't directly override someone else's manifestations, we can adjust our own subconscious to achieve our original goal, despite the other person's desires and, presumably, what they are manifesting. But then, it's not clear how this differs from actively overriding someone else's manifestation. I think the fundamental issue here is that we can't all be God. Manifestation philosophy wishes to make us all immensely powerful, but it's unclear how this interacts with everyone else's near infinite power, and how their manifestations might be able to simply cancel out mine, and vice versa. Sometimes, manifestation thinkers try to counter this by saying that there is a natural harmony to the universe, and that if we follow that harmony, then all of our manifestations will be reconciled into one coherent whole. But then, this begs the further question, what is this harmony, and how can I justify just wishing for whatever before I know if it's in line with the infinite will of the universe? Finally, manifestation undermines some of our most treasured epistemological standards. It asks us to believe in things before we have any direct evidence that they will happen, and to totally suspend doubt. I don't have anything against leaps of faith in principle, and I have defended them elsewhere. But the idea that we cannot even question whether something will occur, or else it never will, severs our predictions of the future from any impartial evidence about what might actually take place. It also makes the law of attraction entirely unfalsifiable. If I attempt to manifest something and it doesn't appear, then there is always a ready explanation. I must have doubted my manifestation at some level, even if it's just a subconscious one. Of course, this is basically a self-fulfilling prophecy. If I've manifested something and it doesn't appear, then it is reasonable for me to doubt it. And then this shows why it didn't happen in the first place. Effectively, as soon as someone asks why their manifestation did not occur, they provide positive evidence of their doubt, which can then be used to explain their failure. This is, to put it lightly, not an epistemically virtuous situation. It insulates the hypothesis from almost any investigation and holds the failed manifester totally responsible for the law not working, as opposed to ever questioning whether the law itself might be faulty. It transforms doubt into an ethical failing. And as a philosophy enthusiast, it's unsurprising that I find this a little bit fishy. It also makes manifestation pseudoscientific under Karl Popper's falsifiability criteria. And look, I've been quite harsh on manifestation so far, because I think it's not very plausible, has significant epistemic flaws, and multiple internal tensions and contradictions, especially at the ethical level. However, I'm also hesitant to mock or deride people that truly do believe in manifestation, because I think it helps to fulfill a particular set of philosophical needs that are quite deeply ingrained within us, or at least found in quite a lot of people. And I think it's worth thinking about what believing in manifestation does for someone, rather than simply using it as kindling for our own budding superiority complex. As is often the case, there is something to learn by employing a little bit of empathy. 4. Why manifestation? There is the obvious first point. Manifestation is a pretty sweet deal if it works. A lot of our problems are simply material and physical. We don't have enough money, we hate our job, or we're just trying to succeed in the ever-important and ever-bewildering game of love. The idea that we can ask and the universe will grant our wish exactly how we articulate it has an appeal well beyond most religions, and certainly over the view that we live in a cold, uncaring universe. As we said in the last section, it is an empowering philosophy. Much like certain mystical traditions that say that we can obtain supernatural abilities, manifestation promises to make us more powerful in this material plane. It does not delay gratification to the next life, but increases our capabilities in our current one. When I was reading some of these manifestation manifestos for this video, I was struck by their sheer rhetorical appeal. I found myself imagining a world where it did work, and thinking how great that would be. We could easily eliminate hunger and disease, since everyone could simply think themselves into abundance and health. It is unfortunate that this is not the case, but I genuinely wish that it were. Unluckily, the heavy dose of chance involved in each of our lives is just something that we have to accept. Many philosophers have grappled with this over the past few thousand years. Boethius bemoans the inconstancy of Lady Fortuna in his Consolation of Philosophy, while the Stoics discussed just how much of our life was outside of our control. Their advice was not to pretend that we could affect the entire world, but to accept what was in our hands. These are, admittedly, a much harder sell, and yet they have one distinct advantage. They let us know that some things are genuinely not our fault. There is radical responsibility, sure, but only over our characters and our actions. The rest are seen as out of our control, except when we can affect them via our behaviour. There is a point at which empowerment becomes unrealistic and maybe even toxically positive, and I think that manifestation has certainly reached that point. I'm also struck by manifestation's proposal that the universe is of one being with our minds. I don't think that many of us appreciate just how existentially comforting this can be. In The Myth of Sisyphus, Albert Camus talks about how it would satisfy much of our own internal existential angst to know that the universe was like us in some way, that it too could think, feel, and have ideas, that it could be communed with and that it had a meaning. It could act. This is reflected in manifestation, where the universe is treated as a very powerful friend, or a genie, as Byrne puts it. While it does not prescribe a meaning for life, it does describe a fundamentally caring universe. Moreover, the idea that we are an abstract kind of energy heavily implies that we may be able to transcend this mortal plane, even if this belief is not outright stated, or at least not always outright stated. Above all, manifestation dispenses with arbitrariness. Everything happens for a reason, and it goes one step further than most major world religions. Whereas in Christianity, God's plan is often inscrutable and involves mysteries beyond human comprehension like the Eucharist and the Incarnation, manifestation makes the universe's reasoning the same as human reasoning. Gone is the eldritch awe and terror inspired by an almighty God, or the horror of an empty, uncaring universe. In its place is a reality with a fundamentally human face, guided by our human wishes and human desires. It fits Camus' criteria for existential comfort more than almost any other worldview that I have come across. It's not surprising that it's become so popular. Manifestation makes us the center of the universe and makes our plans God's plan. And I wanted to end the video on this point. While it is all too easy to turn up our noses at manifestation and those who believe in it, I think we can also empathize. Because the kind of issues that they are seeking to solve, material discomfort, existential dread, a feeling of insignificance in their lives, are exactly the same kind of issues that many of us deal with and are addressed by existential philosophers. If we look at the holes that manifestation is attempting to plug, we can actually get quite a lot of insight into some popular philosophical desires and needs. Equally, while I am heavily critical of manifestation and the implications of its philosophy, I can also understand why it might be appealing to someone, especially if they're feeling helpless. If you truly are in an unbearable situation, I can see how the notion that you can solve it through thought alone would be extremely attractive. The ugly truth is that large swathes of our lives are outside of our control. And this can be overwhelming and make existence seem hopeless. Manifestation does overpromise and underdeliver, but I can also see the attraction. As with a lot of things, I think whether manifestation is helpful or harmful depends on context and scope. If manifestation is simply the aesthetic lens through which someone makes their own life seem meaningful, then while I disagree with them, it is a harmless fantasy. On the other hand, the ethical implications of manifestation as a broad philosophy are pretty worrying. It suggests that the only thing we need to do to solve poverty or war or famine or pestilence is to encourage those who suffer from these to think themselves better, and that if their problems do not evaporate, then that is entirely down to them. This is, in my opinion, an insidious falsehood, and moreover, encourages an excessively egoistic approach to reality, where we only have to look out for ourselves and leave the ever-giving universe to do the rest. In a recent video on the philosophy of conspiracy theories, the YouTuber ContraPoints said, "Astrology is fine so long as astrology knows its place." And this reminded me of a concept from informal logic generally known as warrant. I think this might be helpful when we think of certain ideas like manifestation. When we're considering these theories, we can also consider their warrant. What is justified by the evidence that is provided for them and the arguments in their favour? Manifestation may have warrant as a personal comfort, since this doesn't rely on any evidence that it works in the outside world or on a broader scale, and only on these psychological claims that it might be helpful for an individual to believe in that it might improve their mood. So if someone genuinely does find it helpful and this scope remains at the individual level, then sure, I don't see any major problem with it. But it doesn't mean that it's a well-supported idea, nor does it mean that other people's problems or the manifestor's problems are entirely their fault. There is a difference between something being helpful for someone's individual approach to reality with all of their psychological idiosyncrasies and proposing something as actually true, that is part of the reality we all inhabit, or as an approach that everyone should use. Manifestation seems like it's fine for this first individual task in certain contexts, depending on the person involved, but it is woefully inadequate and unsupported for the second. But if you want more on some of the questionable assumptions in self-help philosophy, then you can check out my video on authenticity right here. Thank you so much for watching, and have a wonderful day.